Welcome to the Daily Elevated Show with Fabian, where we talk culture, technology, philosophy, science, space, and politics. Use logic to dive deep into big questions shaping our world. Get insights into important aspects of life with experts in their fields. Because you should have your mind blown at least once a day. Be elevated daily with the Daily Elevated. And now your host, Fabian Garcia.
Welcome to the Daily Elevated. Today I have a very special guest with me, Victoria Sampson, who is the Washington Office Director for the Secure World Foundation. She has 20 years of experience in military, space, and security issues. She worked as a senior analyst for the Center for Defense Information, where she leveraged her expertise in missile defense, nuclear reduction, and space security issues. She was a senior policy associate at the Coalition to Reduce Nuclear Danger, where she worked with congressional staffers, members of the media, embassy officials, citizens, and think tanks on issues surrounding dealing with national missile defense and nuclear weapons reduction. Before that, she worked on wargaming scenarios with the Missile Defense Agency's Directorate of Intelligence. She is a graduate from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where she got her master's and she got her bachelor's at UCLA. I'm very excited to have her on. I'll shut up now and welcome Victoria Sampson. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm utterly delighted to be here.
Because my readers and listeners and watchers are from all different aspects of life, I wanted to start with the very basic question is, what is space security and why is it important?
Yeah, I mean, it's just getting down to brass tacks at the very beginning. You know, why does space matter? I think a lot of people who are not involved in space think of space as something like, oh, it's NASA, you know, putting people up in the space station or maybe doing investigations and sending rovers up to Mars or what have you. And obviously that is a part of it. But space is part of our daily lives. Every single person on this planet is a user of space data through GPS, through economic transactions, through, you know, how our society communicates, you know, depending on for weather, all sorts of things. And so when we talk about space security, we're really talking about the stability and the predictability of continued access to space. You know, are there things that are going to interfere with our ability to get that data when we need it? And these can be things that are more innocuous, you know, not deliberate threats. And we usually talk about that in terms of space flight safety. So things like trash on orbit or debris, as we call it, things like solar flares affecting the satellite's longevity, things like that. But then there's other things, more deliberate hostile threats. And that's where things, we call them counter space capabilities, but the idea that there's anything that would deliberately interfere with someone else's ability to use space. And that could be, you know, hitting it with a missile, that could be broadcasting over it, that can be getting up close and interfering to it with, in some way, shape, or form. That can be a cyber attack, that can be lasers, it can be all sorts of things. But that's primarily what I focus on, is the space security side of the discussion.
I think a lot of people, maybe up until this point, haven't realized the gravity of the situation and what you actually do. Because if you didn't have what you had in space right now, you wouldn't have no GPS, you wouldn't be able to transmit financial data, you would have basically no internet, no telephone, data transfer, no television, no navigation, no scientific exploration. Like, there is everything that we have in our modern world is possible because of what we have in space, where we're able to transmit data. And if any one of these a million things that can go wrong, thank God they haven't. But if any of them do, then we're going to have a bad situation in our hands. And I think if people realize that this is a very grave situation, then they would pay attention to it more, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I think it's almost to the point where it's too good. You know, we've all grown up with having, you know, these things just dependable and there and reliable, and you don't have to think about it. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there are things that could interfere with it. There has been a space race, you know, there has, you know, it's been part of the I think U.S. Russian / Soviet relations since the beginning of the space age, you know, which dates back to the 1950s or even earlier, if you want to count the rise of ballistic missiles. So, I mean, it's something that's just kind of been a background hum, but particularly recently, I think we've seen more of an increase and more countries getting interested in developing these counter space capabilities, just because I think more governments are recognizing what you just said, Fabian, is that space is such a key enabler for how our societies and economies and militaries function that we need to, you know, governments want to make sure it's there over the long term and predictable. And that is, you know, I won't say that space has never been under threat. I mean, you know, the very first anti-satellite weapon where we launched a missile against a satellite that was tested by the United States in 1959. So obviously this is not new, but we're seeing more of an increase and we're seeing an uptick and this sort of, I think, research and development. And there's a lot of discussions internationally about this as well.
So for people wondering, what exactly do you do on any given day? Can you walk us through a day in your life?
You sound like my family. They still don't understand. So I live and work in DC. You're currently seeing my kitchen. My office is in DC itself. And so my organization, the Secure World Foundation, we're a private organization, an NGO that focuses on the long-term sustainable use of outer space. So we promote best practices, norms of behavior to make sure that space is accessible to and usable for all of the long term. We're a small organization. You know, I'm the head of the DC office. That's like five and a half people. And the other half are in Colorado where our headquarters are because our founder lives there. And so what we do is we really work on the policy side of these issues. You know, one of the things I always tell engineers and scientists who work on space issues is probably my bias because my degree is in political science. I'm not a real scientist by any stretch of the imagination. But if you don't have the policies and laws in place to let you do your thing, it doesn't matter if you can do it on a technical or engineering level, you cannot do it. And so that's really what we focus on. My organization, you know, gathers together stakeholders on these issues that affect space sustainability and security. And these are entities, you know, government entities, you know, work with people at the White House and the State Department and Defense Department, Commerce, and then working with academic institutions. The commercial sector has become much more involved in these conversations. And then, of course, we do a lot of work internationally as well. The United Nations has a bunch of discussions on these issues. I can go into some detail later if there's any interest. But having said that, you know, then we work with international governments as well, too, who are, you know, looking to develop their own capabilities in these issues and trying to get a sense of where the geopolitical picture stands, that sort of thing. So, I mean, on a very basic level, I think I'm like most people. I get up, I read my email, I read Twitter, read the news. And then, you know, a lot just depends on what's going on. You know, I have a lot of travel to these international discussions, do a lot of writing, articles and to a lesser extent, book chapters, always late, I might add, you know, my apologies to my editors. And then, you know, my organization hosts a lot of events. One of the things we're looking forward to is we're co-hosting, we're co-organizing a conference on space security in Geneva, Switzerland next month, because that's where the branch of the UN that talks about a lot of these sort of issues, the Conference on Disarmament, is located. And so we're going to be having a discussion on issues affecting space security and stability. And so there's a lot of, you know, it is when you're organizing events, picking panelists, figuring out what you're going to speak on, you know, working out questions and, you know, making sure the discussion flows and you have the conversation you want to. And then kind of a big picture sort of thing is that one of the things we've been looking at is that the United States announced earlier this year that it was going to commit not to conduct destructive anti-satellite missile tests. And that's very specifically worded because the idea that the debris that's created, the trash that's created from these tests, where you have again a missile being shot from the ground to hit a satellite up in orbit, they're only done against the country's satellites, so they haven't been used in an active war yet. But the debris that's created just gets kicked all over. You know, it's an imperfect world, and these are literal explosions going on in space, and so oftentimes you might have the target be hit at an altitude that's maybe 200 kilometers. I'm just making numbers up now. But then the debris goes up to 1,000 kilometers. And, you know, to grossly oversimplify things, the higher things are up, the longer it takes to come back down. And that's important because right now we don't have any way to get rid of debris in space. It's up there. It's up there until the Earth's gravitational pull brings it back down, which, depending how up you are, it could be months, years, decades, centuries. Forever, depending how you look at it. So the U.S. made this commitment not to do these anti-satellite missile tests, which my organization's been calling for some time. And so we've really been promoting it and encouraging, you know, other actors, other countries to talk about this as well. And just in the past 6 months, six other countries have made this commitment as well. So that's one of the, kind of the big term, long-term projects, I should say, that we're looking at is saying, okay, how can we have this responsible behavior incorporated at, you know, the national level by many countries, and then maybe even at some point getting it discussed in the UN, which is happening, and maybe even getting a treaty at some point. You know, kind of I talking to people outside of, you know, multilateral discussions, like, oh my god, these things take forever. You're talking about it for months or years or even decades. Yeah, I know, it's frustrating, but that's kind of the point. You know, there's no cop that's going to come by and punish you for doing these things. Countries only support these international initiatives as much as it's to their benefit to do so. And so you want to make sure that you have buy-in and that you have countries understanding why it's important that they agree to this, or they value this norm of responsible behavior. So that's kind of what we do in big picture.
A few things I want to point out of that is this may take months or years, but I mean, we still have philosophies that are hundreds of years old that we're still debating about. Two things to your point about satellites that are exploded in space by ballistic missiles, and then it causes debris. In 2007, the Chinese destroyed one of the satellites with a ballistic missile. It caused 150,000 untrackable pieces of space debris. In 2009, Iridium and Cosmos had a crash of their satellites, which produced about 2,000 trackable and maybe some more untrackable pieces of debris. So this has gotten to this to the point where there's a syndrome called the Kessler syndrome, where essentially it says there's basically a chain reaction that can occur in space from the space debris that would cause space to be, I guess, uninhabitable for humans, or maybe not allow us to even send rockets up into space without being destroyed. With the people who kind of run these countries, how much of a teaching lesson do you have to kind of instill and say, hey, this is a really big problem? Or do you feel like they kind of grasp it?
I think there's probably a bit of a nudge involved. But yeah, I mean, your point is correct. And I think a lot of people, when we talk about debris in space and, you know, trash encircling the planet, I have a 9-year-old daughter, so I'm very well versed on, you know, cartoon movies. And so the movie WALL-E, people think about, you know, there's this trash encircling, you got to pop out. It's not going to be like that. But it could be points where there's enough debris or trash or what have you in certain orbits that is just too dangerous to use. And you have to, dangerous meaning you have to keep changing your satellite to, you know, avoid hitting debris, because, you know, again, debris is not going to move. It's going to follow laws of physics, and it's, you know, it's going to do what it's going to do. So if you want your satellite to be hit, you have to move it. Each time you move your satellite, assuming you can, not all satellites can be maneuvered like that. It uses a fuel. And as of right now, we don't have any way in which to replace fuel. There are some companies and organizations working on it. It's called satellite servicing, hopefully soon. But for now, we don't have that ability. So if you run out of fuel, your satellite gets shortchanged and you don't get the benefit from that satellite. So yeah, there's a lot of discussions about that. And the same thing, you know, there's organizations and companies and some governments looking at what they call active debris removal. The idea of deliberately going up and taking down, whether it's big pieces of debris or small pieces of debris. There's an argument, which one's more important. But, you know, basically there's enough debris for everyone. We can really focus on it. And so really looking at that, but there's still, it hasn't been proven. Hopefully it'll work at some point. There's been some test cases where they've, you know, done some proof of concept, and, you know, it's making progress, absolutely, but it's not there yet. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, what do we have? Okay, we just need to know we don't deliberately create long-lived debris in orbit. I will point out, you know, one of the things you brought up, Fabian, was the idea of trackable versus non-trackable debris. And I think that's an important distinction, because, again, coming at this from when I've not always been a space person. So coming into this, I kind of assumed, you know, space, someone was keeping an eye on everything up in orbit, kind of like, you know, someone keeps an eye of air traffic control and there's someone monitoring and there's, like, you know, dots moving across the screen and we can always know where everything is at every point. That's not the case. We can only see down to a certain size up to a certain orbit. So generally speaking, if it's smaller than like the diameter of a softball, you know, which is about 10 centimeters, we can't track it. Which is important because stuff that's, you know, smaller than that, at the speeds they're moving, you know, in low Earth orbit, it can be tens of thousands of miles an hour. That's going to make an impact, even if it's, you know, a centimeter piece. And you can imagine if there's humans up there, you definitely don't want to be impacted by that. You know, your satellites obviously don't want to be doing that, your space station. So it's crucial. One of the things my organization puts together is a global counterspace threat assessment, where we look at what we call counterspace capabilities for a lot of countries around the world. And one of the things we have is a lovely table, which shows all the tests have created debris, all the anti-satellite tests have created debris in orbit. And since the 1960s, there has been about 6,300 pieces of trackable debris. And again, as you point out, Fabian, there's probably a lot more we just can't track that's up there from these tests. Some of them have been up there for 50 years or more. And of those, the 6,300 pieces of debris, about 4,400 are still around. So it's up there for a while. Yeah, as you said, China did an anti-satellite test in 2007 that created about 3,000 pieces of tropical debris. A lot of that's still around. The United States had an anti-satellite test in 2008. The United States did it at a low enough altitude that the debris reorbited within a couple years, but there were pieces that were kicked out quite some higher altitude, which meant they're around for a while. In 2019, India had an anti-satellite test that, again, low enough altitude, the debris reorbited within a couple years. But again, it's still up there. And then most recently, in November of last year, November 2021, Russia did an anti-satellite test and they created about 1,500 pieces of tropical debris, most of which are still up there. And so that's a real concern. And so the question is, well, if it's so dangerous, why are countries doing this? That's a good question. I'm not sure. I have never been convinced of the military utility of developing a weapon that destroys the environment you're trying to operate in. The idea, if you're in a battlefield, imagine if all the bullets were still whizzing around there. You would not want to have to deal with that, right? But I'm not a military official, and I think military folks like to tend to have options. And one of the arguments they make for the developing sort of counter space capabilities is like, well, we need to make sure our satellites are protected, so we need to develop these capabilities. Which again, I'm not sure how one leads to the other, but there you have it. But I think again, with this test moratorium, which the United States has announced, I think there's a growing recognition that there are some behaviors that are so just irresponsible in terms of their output that it's to the United States' benefit to say, you know what, we're going to willingly restrain ourselves from doing this kind of behavior because we think it's so bad. And once you get enough countries on board with that sort of thinking, you get a groundswell movement. And these things take a while, but eventually, a norm of behavior emerges where it's considered bad form to deliberately create long-lived debris on orbit. And that's eventually how you get treaties, and that's how you can criticize countries for doing these sort of tests. I will point out there is a thing called the Outer Space Treaty. Dates from the 1960s. It's got great bones. It holds a lot of principles that are, I think, very relevant to today. But it only prevents you from countries from putting weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons in space and on the moon. It doesn't say anything. Like legally, there's nothing wrong with blowing up a satellite in orbit. From a very legal point of view, if you're saying, okay, what do the treaties actually say in this matter? You can say, well, you're not acting with due regard, or that could be a harmful interference. But and so it's helpful to have these norms and eventually discussions, these discussions of responsible behavior, because then you can point to it and say, you know what, the international community thinks this is a bad idea. It's not just me, your geopolitical superpower rival saying it. Everyone's saying that. And so I think that's going to be really helpful over the long term to really make this a more predictable and stable environment.
I want to make it apparent for people who may not understand orbital mechanics or how space works. In space, you can't stop moving. You're going to just sit there in whatever orbit you are. So when you blow something up, you can't get it back. When it's out there, it's out there. The higher you are, the longer it takes for you to get back into the Earth's atmosphere and burn up. So we have to be very careful that this debris is not out there for hundreds or even thousands of years, depending on where it's at, because that ruins that entire orbit for anyone else to use until whatever that is falls down back to the atmosphere and burns up. So it's a very, very serious situation. And then you mentioned something about countries starting to realize that maybe this is not a good thing to do. I found out something today, and I actually didn't know that North Korea actually for a few years sent a satellite up into space itself, which I wouldn't have thought that that was possible with the situation they're in. But what's the process right now of a rogue nation or just a nation sending whatever they want up and doing whatever they want right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question because, I mean, there's a lot of stuff behind it. The idea between national sovereignty is that, countries in theory should be able to do whatever they want as long as they don't harm others. But as you said, there are some actors that have been proven not to be super thoughtful on the international stage, to say the least. And North Korea definitely, they've got a ballistic missile program, and a lot of times the technologies are very similar for satellite launch versus ballistic missile. A lot, in fact, a lot of satellite launch vehicles are often repurposed ballistic missiles. And so when my organization put together our counter space threat assessment, we did include North Korea just because, we're used to dealing with them, looking at them as a nuclear pariah state and that sort of thing. But there wasn't a lot there. in terms of their space stuff. As you said, that they've, you know, they claim they launched a satellite. You know, you can see the launch vehicle go up, but no one ever actually heard the satellite. You know, like, where's the broadcasting? But also, it's kind of at this point, there's no one you really need. You need to get a spectrum from the International Telecommunication Union. Generally speaking, it's considered good form to put out like a notice to mariners in terms of, you know, people that are going to be in the ocean saying, okay, there's going to be a launch and you're going to be downwind. And so we want to make sure you're out of the area. And the same thing, like a notice to airmen, which actually North Korea has done. They put out these notice to airmen and notice to mariners and put out this information, you know, so there is some recognition that there's some responsibilities when you're a launching state. But, you know, when we look at what North Korea is doing and planning for their space program, obviously it's hard to get a lot of really good information, but they don't talk a lot about space weapons. They talk a lot about nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
And they sure talk about ballistic missiles. And, you know, this podcast is being recorded the first week of October. I think North Korea has launched, I don't know, 4 or 6 times just this past week.
Yeah.
They've had an active ballistic missile program. But their space capabilities are extremely limited. And so the question is, you know, are they the biggest threat to space security and stability? You know, they've got a great cyber program. You know, they're really good at that. But, you know, are they going to be launching some sort of weapon up into orbit? I would say probably not. And so that's one of the things that we deal with when we talk about these issues. I think oftentimes people kind of tar all bad actors with the same brush. You don't make good policy decisions when you're doing that because you just don't know. But having said that, again, there's no expectation that you coordinate launches. There's no space traffic management regime. There's nothing like that. Really what there is the U.S. military keeps track of objects in orbit. It's called space situational awareness, the idea of trying to see stuff in orbit. And this dates back to capabilities that were built during the Cold War. And frankly, these are all coming out, initially, these were all radars that were built to identify Soviet ICBMs coming over the North Pole. And then, well, they're, you know, keeping an eye out for that. And then they said, oh, and actually we're also seeing these objects in orbit, these satellites and debris. Okay, we'll create a catalog of that too. But it's very much secondary. And so it's kind of grown from there. So, I mean, then so the U.S. military sends out what they call conjunction messages, these conjunction warnings, the idea that you could have a close approach with a piece of debris or another satellite. But that's just purely, frankly, out of the U.S.'s good heart, you know, its idea that it's a, you know, it's in the U.S.'s benefit to make sure there's not crashes on orbit because that creates debris and that becomes an issue. But there's no like international regime to send it to. There's no one to coordinate it with. So, I mean, there's a lot less coordination and space stuff than you would actually think. You know, so it's been very interesting to see this happen, you know, when people talk about, well, how do we get them all working together? I mean, really, that's where you have these discussions at the United Nations. That is going to be a crucial part of it. So we'll see what ends up going on with that.
So Russia's been threatening to knock out communication satellites. They tried hacking Starlink. You know, Elon came out and he said, we're going to take a little while doing other things because we have to make sure that they can't hack it. I've also heard I don't know if this is true or not, but I've heard that some groups hacked into their GLONASS or their version of our GPS. Is Russia still providing data to deter collisions with us, or has that gone out the window lately?
So in terms of sharing data for like space situational awareness, as far as I know, the U.S. does not bring in data officially from other entities. And these are, you know, government, like Russia has their own SSA system. To a lesser extent, the Chinese are developing one. The Europeans have their own version. India is developing one. Japan's got a local one. And then there's a commercial sector, commercial SSA. So there's all these different variants of, you know, what sort of SSA capabilities there are. So there's no, I don't, they're looking at ways in which they can bring in outside data, but it's hard. From a classification viewpoint, you know, because a lot of the space stuff is just classified really quickly. But then also just the sheer factor of like the data is in different formats and how do you, you know, ingest it across something that's very different. And frankly, the US SSA computational system dates back like 20, 30 years ago. It's old. They keep saying it's 5 years away from being redone. So surprisingly old fashioned. But I mean, and I think the larger question, though, about countries like Russia, what do you do about them? I mean, it's really interesting. they, you know, like I said, the United States was the first one to test an anti-satellite weapon in 1959. The Russian Soviet Union was pretty close on their heels. You know, for a long time, it was the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, you know, testing these anti-satellite weapons. And then right around the time of the end of the Cold War, you know, 1992-ish, there was about a 10-year break. And then things picked up again. So Russia has been part of the International Space Station, which is a truly international effort to keep humans up in orbit. There have been humans continuously in orbit since the year 2000. And the space station was built specifically to have two sides. One side is the Russian side. They're involved in moving the station about. And the other side is called the US side, but it's really the US, Canada, Japan, Europe. And they're involved in like generating electricity and power for the space station. But the International Space Station was built specifically so that both sides are needed. It is truly international. You truly need both sides. And so you have cosmonauts and astronauts and all working together on it. The space station, the National Space Station, originally was going to be ending in 2024. At the end of, the United States wants to extend it until about 2030 with the idea that you know, will give time for replacements, like a commercial space station or something like that will take its place, just because, you know, it's getting old. Things eventually wear out. Mm-hmm. And then most of the partners have said yes. Now, Russia keeps making noises like, oh, maybe we won't, you know, maybe we'll do our own thing. You know, part of the reason why the United States wanted Russia involved in the space station, it was not just a matter of getting Cold War scientists off the market, but because they actually did have a lot of space. They had three space stations during the Cold War. They had expertise. So in theory, they do have expertise to do their own space stations. Having said that, they don't have the money. They've had a huge problem with corruption. They have a problem with quality control. And because of sanctions, they don't have access to a lot of technologies. So, I mean, every so often you'll read a Russian official say, well, maybe we'll do our own space station. But it turns out, you know, I just read something today where they said, okay, it might take a while, so we'll probably just keep on with the International Space Station until our
system. Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Yeah. They just said that.
Yeah. But I mean, that still doesn't matter. You know, they are, as you said, they're a bad actor. When, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine, they released a cyber attack against some Viasat ground terminals. So basically to interfere with the Ukrainian military communicating over satellite communications. When Russia invaded Ukraine, they, you know, made veiled threats about, well, maybe we're going to plunge a space station into the ocean. They're not. They have their own cosmonauts on there, but, you know, it's still kind of a jerk thing to do and, you know, well within their wheelhouse to say that sort of thing. But they also said, you know, again, when they invaded Ukraine, they were on tap to launch a bunch of country satellites, and that's not unusual. They can do, you know, they're really good launchers. They're cheap. They're reliable. They kind of held a few hostage and said, we're not going to do it until you say, you know, they won't be used against us in war. And then it was companies called OneWeb. OneWeb's like, no, you can't say that. And so I think Russia still has their 30 satellites. And basically that meant no one was going to let Russia launch the satellites. So Russia's being isolated in terms of that. Because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, they were going to be doing some efforts with the European Space Agency to work on a Mars mission. And the European Space Agency said, you know what, can't do it, you're out. And so Russia is becoming increasingly isolated, self-imposed. Mm-hmm. But that's one of my concerns is that, you know, Russia doesn't have a commercial space industry that just dates back to the Soviet times. Never real fan of that sort of thing. Their civil space agency and their civil space efforts are being isolated, again, rightfully so, because of their efforts. So that leaves them the only place where they can still be really a geopolitical power is their military space capabilities. And I worry about that. I worry that they're going to look at saying, well, if we want to demonstrate, you know, we've been a leader in space since the beginning. This is how we continue to be a leader. And by developing these military space capabilities, like the anti-satellite test they had last year. So I think it definitely bears keeping an eye on.
If people don't know this, but China has their own space station that is basically brand spanking new, just off the lot, mm-hmm. That they built because the U.S., didn't allow them to get into the ISS, so they went about their own way. I don't know that and obviously you would have more insight to this, but I don't know that it behooves China to let Russia in what they're doing. Does it at all? I mean, do they offer anything? Do they bring anything to the table that China can't already get itself?
Yeah, I mean, no. At this point, China and Russia have a really interesting relationship. It used to be, you know, Russia was the senior partner there, and when it comes to space stuff. And China was the junior partner. And so Russia would share technology with China, but very carefully so that they wouldn't get to be too good at space. You know, last year, China and Russia signed a memorandum of understanding, basically an agreement, saying that they would work together in what they call an international lunar research station, that they're going to build something together on the moon. It's been very vague as to what that'll be or how it happened. But obviously that was pre-Ukraine. And so now the question is, you know, does China get any benefit from this? You know, Russia is obviously distracted. Their funding is being siphoned off elsewhere. You know, they're not bringing much to the table in terms of partnership. So, but yeah, I mean, the Chinese space station, I think, will be fully operational later this year, or maybe early next. And so it's been really interesting to see, you know, while the International Space Station is, no, I won't say coasting on fumes, but, you know, it's nearing the end of its life.
Yeah.
And the Chinese one is coming on board. And, you know, if I were the Chinese, I would definitely be using it as the U.S. and its allies did for the space station. You know, the ISS, I think, was helpful in terms of, you know, doing experiments and things like that. But truly what it was is a diplomatic tool. And if I were the Chinese, I would be using their space station as a diplomatic tool to do soft power outreach to countries that I wanted to develop a relationship with. Now, the question is, will Russia be one of them? I don't know, again, because I think they would have to be, you know, a junior partner, and there would be some ego involved, and, you know, no longer being the primary entity of the way it has been, you know, literally from the beginning of the space age. But, you know, who knows? A lot can change.
It's such an interesting time when you have these space capabilities and the ability to shoot down satellites and kind of just ruin humanity. I feel like everything's brewing up into a climax. And what is over that hill, we don't know, but hopefully we stroll around to tell the story. I know that you were a senior policy associate at the Coalition to Reduce Nuclear Dangers. When dealing with the possible regime change in a nation like Russia that has obviously tons of nuclear weapons, how do we go about securing the global interest of having those weapons secure during a possible transition?
Yeah, I don't know there's any one good answer to that. I will point out that we have experience in this. You know, when the Soviet Union fell apart, you had nuclear weapons scattered across different aspects of the former Soviet republics. And so there had to be all sorts of agreements within, you know, Ukraine and, you know, Russia and all these different Kazakhstan, you know, just saying, okay, here's how we agree, you know, I think I'd have to the specifics, you know, repatriate the nuclear weapons, but basically, you know, allowing Russia to be the successor state and to follow through on that. And we were lucky, you know, it could have gone in a much different manner than it did. And part of it was because there were a lot of people putting a lot of time and a lot of energy and a lot of thought into making sure that, you know, the Russian government had an incentive to maintain control of the nuclear weapon arsenal. And again, that the nuclear scientists were not desperate and ready to sell their services to the top bidder. The United States had a program called the Cooperative Threat Reduction Program, with the idea that they would try and provide, you know, stuff for them to do that would you know, get them off the market. So I think, I don't know what's going to happen in terms of the regime, the Putin regime. I don't think it would end quietly. But I would like to, you know, I will point out with some optimism that we have gone through this before and we're able to, knock wood, avoid nuclear conflict. And I'm hoping that, you know, no one wants to see the world end. And that's truly what a nuclear weapons exchange would be. Just it'd be world ending. And, you know, the Russians have families too. So I think that, you know, hopefully there'll be people with the right, you know, incentives and the right attitudes to ensure that they're not being, you know, used at all, hopefully.
All of our ICBMs are basically, I believe, Minuteman III, which we've been refurbishing and keeping alive for a long time. And it's extremely expensive and extremely technical. With the brain drain happening in Russia and the inability to get the chips that they need and just the overall cost to just upkeep these missiles. I mean, I've read reports that people say, like, we don't even know if their missiles will actually launch. And if they do, how many are would be operable and what would happen? Would some explode in the silo? Like, it's such an unknown, really interesting thing to think about.
It is. I mean, I think with not speaking as an expert in the Russian nuclear arsenal, but I will say from a lot of people who watched how the Russian military did in Ukraine this past spring, a lot of people were surprised. Really surprised, you know, they did not do well. They are not doing well. No. And part of that wasn't, you know, kudos to the Ukrainians for fighting valiantly. Like, I don't want to downplay their efforts. I mean, absolutely, they've been doing amazing. But also the Russian military was poorly kitted out. You heard crazy stories about, the paratroopers not having parachutes and, things like that. How predictable and usable are their nuclear weapons? I don't know. I don't know that I'd want to, some people say, well, they probably wouldn't work anyway, so let's just play with, dice. Like that's not where I'm going with this. Please let's not do that. But I mean, this is a regime that is having issues maintaining personnel in its military. It's spending a tremendous amount of money that it does not have, being isolated with the sanctions and things like that. So they could decide just to kind of, it's hard to say what they're going to be doing in the future. But yeah, it's something, in terms of on our side, on the US side, one of the things that's always been interesting is saying, well, how many nuclear weapons do you need to have to feel safe and secure? It's hard to say, how many do you need to be able to respond to? And that's, during the Cold War, there's the idea of a missile gap, that the United States didn't have as many missiles as the Soviet Union, and therefore we were going to be unprotected. And as it turned out, as more information came out later on, it turned out we had way more than they did. So that wasn't even an issue. But it's that mentality, right? You need to have 100 ICBMs that can respond. You need to have 1,000, you need to have 3,000. And a lot of that just depends on the speaker, And so I'm hoping that there are going to be people within the US military that will, look at what one of the biggest threat concerns have been, a geopolitical superpower rival of Russia, and say, okay, maybe what we thought we knew about their capabilities is not what's actually there. And that, I don't say we need to like dump everything immediately, but maybe that rethink some of the priorities and the spending and, and the efforts we've been doing and really look at, okay, what is a threat that actually exists?
I'm not an expert on missile defense, but I do really like to watch a lot of videos and learn as much as I can, especially since this war started. I mean, I've been obsessed with just everything in this war. I don't think we've ever had the ability to see in almost real time what's happening on the battlefield, to the point where on the Ukraine Reddit, they ask people, hey, can you stop posting videos because you're ruining OPSEC, operational security, because the Russians would be looking at the pictures and then geolocating where it's at and then sending artillery to it. I know some of the Wagner group got wiped out that way. One of the commanders took a picture in front of the office, the building, and he posted the address and they aimed the artillery and they destroyed, I think, like 400 Wagner group mercenaries, which, that was a good thing for Ukraine. The INF Treaty that we were a part of, the Soviets and the US in 1987 signed the INF Treaty, which banned long-range ballistic missiles. So we didn't really have anything other, I believe, over 300 kilometers. And China saw that, and they saw how the US, when they invaded Iraq, they kind of just gathered all their forces just outside where Iraq could hit them with their missiles. And they created this, the PLA rocket division, I guess. It has 200,000 people, and they've tested over 250 long-range ballistic missiles. And I believe Trump got out of that treaty in 2019, but I'm wondering, is it too late? Have we fell behind so far compared to where the Chinese are currently at with long range ballistic missiles, or is there a chance for us to catch up and even overtake them?
I would actually say it's them catching up to the US. The US always has the most amount of things, no matter what. And that's part of the hard discussions when we talk about US security and looking at, China's advancement. I think a lot of people tend to look at it as they're, beating us or they're getting out ahead. No, they're slowly catching up to where we are, which changes things, but it's not like we're being left behind. So let me maybe hopefully rest assured on that part of it. But things like the INF Treaty, I mean, that was just a US-Russia treaty. It was not a global treaty. It wasn't, China was not involved in any way, shape, or form. And there's, and that was because the US had long had concerns about Russia actually following through on the articles of the treaty. I don't know if there's a discussion about maybe extending it or revamping it or doing something, again with China. But that, all these nuclear arms control treaties have been, US-Russia or US Soviet Union and then Russia. So there's discussion like maybe you want to do trilateral or bring in the Chinese or have US China. So it's difficult to say. But again, I will say again, the US has a much larger nuclear arsenal, a much larger ballistic missile arsenal, a longer ICBM program, basically more of everything. Now, does that more mean that you're secure? Not necessarily, but it's a different discussion point than coming at it from if it were the other way around.
Got it. And for the last 10 minutes or so that I have you, I did want to move into kind of some more futuristic type of I guess a discussion on space ethics and the future of space travel and human travel through space, because I know a lot of it's not been written. I know it's people are, as yourself, are kind of trying to think of how this would work. But I'm thinking, when humans start traveling to the moon and all that, have we figured out who's going to have control of what there? Is there some kind of like treaty on the moon, or some agreement that it's nobody's or it's somebody's? And what's been done in that realm?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned the Outer Space Treaty, and there's an article in there that says basically space is for all of humanity. And so you cannot, what they call, appropriate or take over certain aspects of it. And the Outer Space Treaty, as I said, doesn't say anything about bombs in space or, you know, anti-satellite weapons, but it says you cannot put a military installation on the moon. It's very clear, the moon and other celestial bodies. So there are some restrictions in regards to that. But as you point out, there's more and more efforts being done to put bases on, or, you know, do more. I won't say bases, we're not even at that point yet, but looking at having projects and, you know, things on the moon. You know, I want to say there's like 20 different countries that have moon missions over the next decade or so. A lot of countries do. And so you say, okay, well, we need to, if not necessarily coordinate, because not all these countries are countries that the United States works with, we need to be able to deconflict. You know, making sure that we're not fighting over the same, you know, spot to land our moon rover, our moon lander, that sort of thing. So there are discussions internationally about, you know, what they call space resource use. The idea of how do you coordinate and make sure that people, you know, it's a shared approach. How do you do that? Because, you know, you don't want someone to, I think people who are new to this issue think that, you know, we're going to go up to the moon and get some, you know, get some mineral that's a rare on Earth, and where someone's going to become a trillionaire. When I first started working these issues, it was like, oh, the trillionaire is going to be a space investor. No, that's not going to happen. But really what's going to happen is there are going to be some sites that are better for landing purposes. And so you're going to be able to develop your moon, you know, stations better. Or frankly, you're going to be able to get the ability to make water, which is really important if you're going to be doing future planetary exploration. And so there are concerns about that. So there are discussions at the United Nations talking about this sort of thing. How do you do it in an equitable manner? They have, you know, free access, that sort of thing. It's not definite yet. There was actually a moon treaty, but I want to say only 20 countries signed it. None of the countries that need to ratify. I don't count it as an actual treaty. But I think that the principles in the Outer Space Treaty are helpful. You just have to figure out, like anything, how do these principles apply in this new circumstance? You know, as things evolve, how do you do that? And one of the things that the United States has been doing is they've got this thing called the Artemis Accords, where they say, and this was launched maybe a couple of years ago, and they've got over like 20 countries have signed on to it, that they say, okay, here are some principles we see in the Outer Space Treaty that are relevant to the future use of space and the evolution of planetary exploration, and we want to do it in a cooperative, sustainable manner. And so we agree to follow these things, and then they have other new stuff like deconfliction, things like that. It's kind of weird because it's not a treaty. It's a bunch of bilateral agreements the United States is doing with a bunch of other countries. But the idea is to try again. You have to demonstrate what a norm is. And so how do you go about doing that? And this is one way in which you can do that. Say, okay, this is how the astronaut community demonstrates responsible behavior on the moon, is by sending the Artemis Accords. Having said that, it is a U.S. initiative. And so you can imagine that countries the United States does not get along with have zero interest in signing the Artemis Accords, i.e. Russia and China. And so for one thing, I've been really interested to see is, you know, at a certain point, again, pre-Russia's invasion of Ukraine, but it almost seemed like we're having this parallel path going. We have the U.S. and the Artemis Accords in one direction for how you want to use the moon and, you know, do planetary exploration and things like that. Then you have like Russia and China signing their International Lunar Research Station and kind of going the other way. And and at one point, you know, they had said, okay, anyone who wants to join us can, and the European Space Agency was kind of making noises about it. And then, of course, Russia invaded Ukraine and pulled out. So I'm not sure. You know, I don't think they're necessarily competitive. Like, in theory, they are complementary, but it will just depend. It will see. And one thing to point out, I know we're getting close on time, but the U.S. actually has congressional limitations in terms of how much it can do with China in space. It's called the Wolf Amendment. It doesn't prevent it. Basically, I like to say it puts speed bumps in terms of the White House doing bilateral issues with China specifically, or NASA doing things bilaterally with China. So if they want to do that, they have to get the FBI to sign off. They have to, you know, prove that they're not, you know, sharing information. They're not working with the human rights violators. And they have to notify Congress at a certain period of time. So they can do it. You can imagine it's a pain. And so oftentimes they just don't. Now, that doesn't mean they can't do stuff in a multilateral setting. And that's where, you know, they have these discussions. But yeah, and so I think it's, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. So that's also something to think about again. Well, how do we approach these new uses of space? We have these congressional restrictions that I think hamper the U.S. ability to at least deconflict one of the major space actors out there. So again, it's one of those things we're going to see how it evolves. Again, this Russia's invasion of Ukraine has really upended a lot of stuff, and maybe countries are rethinking how they approach this. Just recently, the UAE signed an agreement to do something with a lunar rover with China. And the thing that I found really interesting is that UAE is also a signatory of the Artemis Accords, and they're one of the first ones that kind of made a bridge. So who knows? Maybe other countries will follow, and it's not going to be the parallel competitive path that I was worried about. We'll see how it ends up evolving.
Yeah, I definitely do see a hindrance in so much and having so much bureaucracy, which, I mean, you know, when you're worried about human rights violations, obviously it comes from a good place. But in space and in innovation, China is just doesn't really have all that bureaucracy. Whatever President Xi says goes. So they're able to do things without having all this, you know, tests and red tape and EIRs and all this stuff. They just do it. So I'm wondering, like, what are we giving up to be a moral light upon the world, I guess you could call it, compared to what China is doing? And then the other thing I was thinking about is, as you were saying earlier, that no one has an appropriation of any celestial body, but it almost seems like that's impossible to happen, because you have Russia who has, let's say they have a lunar base, China has a lunar base, US has a lunar base. The citizens of those lunar bases aren't citizens of the moon, they're citizens of the countries here on Earth. So I'm thinking, how do you actually make that all happen, like a melting pot, without having conflict? I almost think it's inevitable, sadly.
Yeah, I mean, I like to think that we've been able to avoid conflict so far. And so my hope is that it's not inevitable. I think a lot of people watch the Netflix series about the moon and the Space Force. And then if you watch the Netflix series, you remember, like, it was a whole plot point with the U.S. versus the Chinese, you know, space stations. They're constantly sabotaging each other and all that. I mean, maybe. Who knows? I will say, you know, there are things called, you know, there's a rescue agreement, which basically says it's more for people like astronauts landing on Earth, but you'll help return them. I mean, space is a hostile environment just in general. It's hard for us to live up there. And so my hope is that living in a hostile environment, just because you are literally a small group in a very difficult situation, that would maybe let you put some of the national animosity aside and let me say, how do we do this so we can survive together? So that is my hope. We'll see how that ends up happening.
Things are happening so quickly now. I mean, we are moving at a breakneck pace with change and technology. It's just getting almost to the point where it's too much to keep up with even. I mean, I spend a lot of time a day just keeping up with what's happening in the world. I try to do it at a more than superficial level, and it's getting so interconnected and so complicated. I know Elon Musk said, you know, he wants to have a colony on Mars. And number one is, I don't even know if they'll let him. But I like that he says, he goes, we have such a massive system here that we didn't really do it right, but it's the only system that we have. Hopefully, at least on Mars, we can start like a direct democracy where people actually vote themselves rather than a representative democracy where you have people who have their own self-interest. So, I mean, it's going to be such an incredible thing. I just hope that I live long enough so that I can download my brain into a computer and then live for the next few hundred years.
That is the dream. I don't know. You're right. Things are changing rapidly, but, you know, I mean, it's weird. Like, I know people who have actually been up in space through commercial space flight, and I never would have anticipated that even just a couple of years ago. So who knows? I mean, these things can evolve, and hopefully they'll evolve in a manner that's sustainable and allows everyone to get the benefits of space. And that's one of the things my organization is working hard to do.
Can you tell people how they can get a hold of you, the socials and all that?
Sure. Our website is we're the Secure World Foundation, and our website is S as in secure, W as in world, found as in foundation, so swfound.org. We have, and that's also our Twitter handle. I'm on Twitter as of some of my colleagues, bsampson_DC. Yeah, we're always happy to talk to people and, you know, help people learn more about the issue.
And by the way, the website has a lot of content on it. It has a lot of really good PDFs that I've actually read through a few, very interesting stuff, especially when it comes to the SSA space situational awareness. It's something that I hadn't really dived into, and I think it's incredible. I'm going to spend a lot more time getting into it. But I really do want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. I know you were just in Geneva, you were in Hawaii, you were traveling all over the world doing this and helping the world become a safer place. So I do want to thank you and commend you for the job that you do, from myself and from everyone that didn't even know what you do, and now they understand the gravity of the situation that you deal with day in and day out. Is there anything that you'd like, any last words that you'd like to leave us with?
Just that I think, space is for everyone. It is accessible to everyone. The data is there for everyone. And so we all have, I think, a role to play and an importance to play to make sure that's done in a sustainable, predictable, reliable manner. And I will point out again that my degree is in political science. I'm not a real scientist. And so I think a lot of people, when they learn about these space issues, they think, oh, it's only for scientists or engineers or physicists. And really, I think if anyone's interested in the space industry, the space sector, there's roles for lawyers and teachers and artists and graphic designers, you know, all sorts of facts of people. So I definitely encourage you to learn more about the issue. And if it's interesting to you, I think there's a place for everyone up in space.
Absolutely. And I'll second that. I went to school for political science. I wanted to be in Congress, or actually I want to work for the UN. But I learned about space just because I was so infatuated with the ability that we can expand and become whatever we're going to turn into as humanity. So I definitely second that thought. If you like this talk and you're like, well, I want to get involved, but I don't know all this stuff. Neither did I. Neither did anybody until you learn it. And there's a lot of opportunity, especially with the commercial space program and all these private companies that are getting involved now. There is something for everyone. So please check out Victoria on Twitter. Check out the Secure World Foundation. I hope that everyone listening got a taste of what it is to work in a space industry and what it exactly is that we're trying to do as humans and in the future. So thank you so much.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much, Fabian. This is great. I really enjoyed myself. Thank you for having me.
All right. And I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you for listening to the Daily Elevated Show with Fabian. Please hit that subscribe bell if you liked our content and would like to listen again. It really helps more people find us. And check out dailyelevated.com for important and unbiased news. Dailyelevated.com. News for busy but curious people.